The second plenary session is sponsored by Sententia and will focus on cyber, emergent risks, new opportunities. Tony Visser will talk about the who and how of hacks. Chris McKinnon will discuss what happens after a malicious cyber attack, and Susie Amos will present what the insurance market is currently doing and what insurers should be doing about cyber risk. Please keep your questions to the end. There'll be an opportunity to ask any questions that you have, and you'll again be sent an SMS to ask for speaker feedback for the start at the start of the Q&A, and you'll receive a new link. Tony has an accomplished technical and engineering background, having completed his Bachelor in Science and Computing Science from the University of Technology, Sydney, and recently completed his Global Executive MBA from the University of Sydney, which includes study at Stanford University, the London School of Economics, and the Indian Institute of Management. He is currently completing his CISSP certification and is a member of the Australian Information Security Association and is also associated with the Australian Cybersecurity Centre. Sententia is a thought leader and an award-winning provider of services in the cybersecurity field and recognised as possessing some of the most comprehensive accreditations in the nation today. Please welcome Tony Visser.
Can everyone? Yep, beautiful. All right, Natasha, thank you very much for the introduction. And before I start, let me just say I'm in awe of some of the things that I've seen and heard, especially by being surrounded by people that are so intelligent in terms of the statistics and the logic and the mathematics element. I did part of that as part of my degree, and I must say I had hair before I did that, and I lost it all by the end of it. So without further ado, let's start off. So I'm here today to talk about cyber trends and threats today. And I'm going to start off by asking the question, when you think of the term hacker or cyber criminal, what comes to mind? I presume something like this. A guy in a hoodie wearing sunglasses in pitch black darkness. Or potentially these guys. And these people make the news quite often. Anonymous. They apparently hacked into Hillary Clinton's email a week or so ago. Or was it the Russians? I don't know. Or potentially these people here, and you've all heard of this TV show. So the fact of the matter is that hackers are actually none of these things at all. The average hacker today is about 35 years of age. 80% of them do this as a profession, so they don't actually do this for fun. I got started off hacking when I was about 15. I hacked into my school's network. I was able to access where the marks are stored, and I was able to change them. I then went to the teachers and I was a goody two-shoes and said to them, I've hacked into my network, our school network, you might want to know about it. And my hacking days ended fairly quickly after that. So to give you some context in terms of how big a problem this is, cybercrime is massive. Estimates between $380 billion by Lloyd's, and I'm sure Chris will be following me in the speaker, will talk a little bit about this. And then some of the IT companies actually talk about 570. In fact, Intel yesterday, I was at a seminar, they say 680 billion. It's a bit of an auction. It's like Sydney, slightly bidding for a Sydney property. the truth of the matter is that the number is probably somewhere in between. But to give you some context in terms of size, these are the top 30 economies in the world, top 20 to top 30. So regardless of where you look at those numbers, it's a massive problem. In terms of global issue, and I hope everyone can see that I've gone in with the white font, our Attorney General has said it's a top line threat to security. The UK has turned around and said that cybercrime is a top three national security priority along terrorism and along with environmental disaster. So it's an area that is massive. We're actually a little bit backwards in terms of how we deal with cybercrime. Most of the advanced economies in the world actually have what's called cyber breach notification laws, i.e. when you get breached, you have to tell somebody. Now, very few organisations in this country have to do that. The banks being and financial institutions are some of the only ones that do have to do that. We do have a newly appointed cyber security minister that works with Malcolm Turnbull, so you can expect that these things will change over time. And to give you some sort of visibility in terms of what's going to happen in future, the US has frameworks around breach notification laws. They are very complicated and very complex. Every state has its own rules. But the EU, just last month, actually implemented what's called General Data Protection Regulation. And that basically says that if you get breached any size business, you have to notify somebody. I'm going to give you some examples in terms of how personally you can very easily be hacked. Now, some of you have probably heard about hacking cars, and it's a very concerning development in the world today. Fiat, who make Jeep, actually released a software patch for their cars in terms of stopping some of the hacks that are happening. An FBI researcher recently logged into a plane's multimedia system and was able to access control of the aircraft's movements. He was able to actually move the plane around very subtly. He didn't want to scare anyone, but then he went back and he told the authorities, look, I've been able to do this. You may want to address this. I'm going to bring it to a much more personal perspective. Who here, raise your hand if you've got Telstra cable at home. I know there's a couple of you. So a million subscribers in the country. So this is a photo of a Telstra cable modem. Gives you fast internet. And when you got this modem, for the people that actually have this, you would have been given a little piece of paper that says, here is your access and here's your password, and with it you can log in and you've got secure access. What Telstra don't tell you is that in the back of these modems, the internal there's an administrator account that they actually have set up for it. And that administrator account allows Telstra to log in and make sure that, you know, the modem's running the way it's meant to be running. It updates the software. The problem with that is that the same username and password applies to every single modem that's ever been made. So with a 10-second Google search, I can potentially access, for the people that have Telstra cable, I can access their network. It won't take very long. Some of you are saying, oh, yeah, but hang on, where do I live? How do you know where I live? Well, you probably have one of these outside your house. If I follow you home tonight, I may know that you've got Telstra cable. A bit more research and I'll be able to access your network. Once I access your network, I can access anything on your network, including your computers that have already selected a trusted network connection. Then I talk about what's called the Wild West. This is an example of a CCTV camera, and a lot of them run on IP networks. The problem with this is that most of the companies that set these things up aren't IT savvy. So they set these things up with very simple or no security whatsoever. That website that I've listed there, insecam.com, is a website where you can browse 7,000 IP surveillance cameras that have been set up with the default usernames and passwords, and you can see inside people's lounge rooms, inside business foyers, inside warehouses, inside pretty much anywhere where someone's put a camera. And it's there, it's available. Completely legitimate. The good news about these guys is that if you tell them, I've got this camera, I've changed my password, they'll get rid of it off their website. This is a diagram of an air conditioning system, and you're probably wondering, oh, why are we talking about air conditioning? Well, most air conditioning systems these days run on IP networks, so they've got diagnostics and they've got bits and pieces that allow the building management system to work out how warm it is, how cold it is, turn it up, turn it down, etc. One of the largest breaches that's ever occurred happened because of an air conditioning system, Target. $162 million and 30 million credit cards were siphoned. And the way that the hackers got in is they accessed the IT systems of the company that was doing the building management for the air conditioning. They got passwords for the network through that company, and they then set up their own infiltration system and siphoned off as many cards as they liked. And then finally, the Achilles heel. This thing. We all have one, every single one of us. We all sit there when we get bored with the presenter and we start reading our messages. We do weird and wacky things. We read our emails. We do our internet banking. Like Lance Armstrong over here, I found a really good Tinder profile example of Lance Armstrong, who is renounced drug use these days. And then some of us also, going to Chow's previous presentation, like to use Pokemon Go. Now, let me ask you a question. With all this technology, if I hack into one of these devices, I can hear everything that's happened, I can see where you are, I can see passwords and emails and contacts, etc., etc. Let's take this boardroom as an example. There's a lot of technology here. You can see smart TVs and you can see video conferencing units. Even in this boardroom here, there's a whole bunch of technology here. I can show you with 10 minutes that I can hack into anyone's phone in here. Very, very easy to do. And it just takes a little bit of trust. Hopefully I've built that trust up while I've been up here, but maybe not. But I can hack into your phone and I can see everything that's going on your phone. And I can demonstrate this if you ask me afterwards. We can potentially talk about it another day. But if I can hear everything that comes through this phone, and let's say this is Coca-Cola's boardroom and they're talking about the next 5-year strategic plan and they're trying to work out, okay, where do we take this business? Where do we go? What new product should we release? Should we rebrand ourselves, etc., etc.? Let's say a hacker's hacked to someone's phone and has recorded everything. And let's say the hacker goes to Pepsi and says, "Hi, Mr. Pepsi, or Mrs. Pepsi. I have some information that I might want to send you about a competitor. Would you be interested?" I'm not saying that Pepsi would say no or yes. I'm just throwing it out there. This is an example where this happened. It's an Australian company. It's a company called Codan. They make metal detectors for military and mining applications. So back in 2013, in February, they posted record profitability. 10 months later, their profitability fell by 80%. Why is this? Very, very simple. This is their share price. Back in 2009, 2010, they started receiving counterfeit metal detectors back at their returns plant in Adelaide. And at first they thought they were just people that had been repairing their metal detectors and doing, you know, weird and wacky things with their products. But as more and more of them started coming in, what they started to realise was it was actually a bigger problem than that. So they thought that someone had reverse engineered their product. What they did was they called the Australian Federal Police and they said, "Look, can you investigate this? Because we don't know what's going on. We think someone's making fake versions of our metal detectors." The AFP got ASIO involved, etc., etc. It was soon found that one of Codan's executives the previous year had gone to Beijing on a business visit. And this executive had logged into the hotel Wi-Fi. In the hotel they were at. Unbeknownst to the person, this network had been compromised, and when this person logged in and pressed trust, "I trust this network connection," they exposed themselves and all the contents of their computer to the hacker. And part of those contents were the blueprints to these metal detectors. And it was quite simple. What happened was that the hacker sold it to the highest bidder, and the company started making metal detectors that undercut them. So I was talking about the share price going up and the profitability going up, etc., etc. Four Corners, at the height of this activity around Codan's share price, aired these claims. They found out that this had happened. And the share price never recovered after that. And in fact, if you look at the latest share price, you'll find that it still hasn't recovered to this day. These people that made metal detectors to compete with Codan's based on their own designs were selling them for $1,500 each, and Codan was selling them for $5,000 each. You can understand things might have hurt the business. Hacking can take many forms. It's not just bad people trying to access and break into people's systems. This is a photo of a lady who last year put $10 on the Melbourne Cup winning horse. She stood to win about $900. She put a photo on Facebook of the winning ticket. Guess what one of her friends did? Printed the photo, cut her out, took the photo to the TAB and cashed her ticket in. And if you can see up there, I know it's quite hard to see, if you have a look just up there, you can see that it's actually on a private setting. So it was one of her friends who actually did it. The other hack that I want to talk about is, I can't really demonstrate it because it takes a bit longer than what I'm giving here today in terms of time, but a gentleman from New South Wales Police Force, he was able to hack into a top four Australian bank by triangulating and working out through Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, etc., who to target within that organisation. He established relationships between people who had the right security credentials on the IT systems, and then he picked up the phone and he asked for a password reset. And the person said, "Okay, no problems." He established trust with the person he was calling. The person reset the password. He had full access into a bank. We do see emails like this. This is one that came to my email account about a week ago. Now, I'm a trained professional. I can see that this is dodgy. But someone who might be an accounts receivable clerk might receive an email like this, between 20 and 30 other legitimate emails that need to be paid in the day. And I'll double-click on the attachment. The attachment's a Word document. This email looks reasonably legit to someone who's not trained. Within half an hour, they get CryptoLocked. Now, CryptoLock in itself is more of a pain in the backside than it is a compromise. It means that the IT administrator needs to take the computer apart, wipe it, do whatever they've got to do, restore it, etc., etc. But it's just a disruption, and not a good disruption, not the buzzword disruption, the actual bad disruption to a business, and it's a risk. If we look at a hack, there's three components to a hack. One is the external intrusion. There's someone trying to get in. And we can do things around that. We can put walls up, and we can put surveillance up, and we can manage that. Two is the poor systems maintenance and the monitoring aspect. So one of the easiest ways to hack into a business is to find flaws with the software or hardware they're running. It might not be patched. It might be an old version of software. It might be an unsupported bit of hardware or something that's over 5-10 years old. And the last one is a lack of education. We talked a little bit earlier today with some of the presenters talking about education. I can tell you that most people are lazy. Look at our own passwords. I can tell you that some of my passwords are lazy. Well, they're a bit stronger these days. But historically, they've been lazy passwords. And as a result, if you don't have the right education, the right training around what to do, it's a very, very easy way for an attacker to get in. So when we talk about risk and when we talk to customers, I've got a very simple approach. I ask them, I say, look, you know your business better than I do. I can pretend to know it. I can study what I know, but you know the ins and outs of your business. On a scale of 1 to 10, where 1 represents low cost, high risk, 10 represents high risk and low cost, where do you want to be? And I'll say, well, what do you mean, what do you mean, what do you mean? Well, I'll say, look, if you're really blasé about your security, that's fine if you are. Then great, don't spend any money on it. That's not a problem. If you're really concerned, then you've got to take that into account and deal with it. And these are the typical attitudes that I find. Is at a 1 out of 10, she'll be right. Or in a few cases, oh, look, it'll be okay, he'll be right. I had a marketing agency that came up to me and they had very basic cybersecurity, and I warned them and I said, look guys, you need to actually do something about this because you have data that's valuable. Their thing was, their reasoning was, oh, why would anyone care about what I've got? I'm only a small business. No one really cares. Within a week, and this wasn't me, by the way. Within a week, a Turkish separatist group who is a known terrorist association hacked into her website and defaced it and put up their propaganda within a week. I don't know how the coincidence happened, by the way. Then you've got people who say, look, cybersecurity is a necessary cost, and most people sort of fall into that space, is that they understand that there's a level of investment involved. And then you've got the people that say, look, we'll pay whatever it is, whatever it takes, we just want to be secure. And we can work along that continuum, and most IT professionals understand this. And there's no right or wrong answer. When the cyber breach notification laws come in, we probably have, at a default, going to have to be at about a 5 to 6 out of 10 anyway. So from an awareness aspect, it's good for you to know. What do we do in terms of how we fit in terms of what you do? Our job is to make it as difficult as possible for someone to get breached. We'll never say that we can prevent it 100% because we just can't. It's impossible. But we do our best. And our job is to minimise that risk. It's to minimise and to maximise the resiliency of that business to be up. And then finally, we like to recommend that people such as yourselves in the room actually pay really close attention to this. We spend probably half of our day reading about the latest hacks, the latest trends, the latest whatever might be happening. And we're professionals. We get paid to do this. And if you work with professionals, then there's a good chance that you'll be on top of this. A lot of just regular IT people have problems just doing their normal day-to-day things. It's a very specialised field, this. So I encourage you to consider it and pay really, really close attention. And on that note, I just wanted to wrap it up and say thank you for your time. And yeah, I'll be here for the rest of the day. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Tony.
Our next presenter is Chris McKinnon. He joined Lloyds in February 2015 as General Representative in Australia and is responsible for market development and for liaising with market practitioners and regulatory authorities to maintain Lloyds' presence in Australia. Chris has more than 27 years' experience in the international insurance industry with extensive knowledge of both the Australian and London markets. Prior to joining Lloyds, Chris was the Chief Executive Officer at Gowgates Insurance Brokers, where he was responsible for the overall management of the group's companies. Chris has previously held roles in global brokerages Gallagher's, Aon and Marsh in both Sydney and London, and he started his career as a Lloyds broker in London working for CT Bowring. Please welcome Chris McKinnon.
Electric shock just to wake me up. Lovely. Is this one working? Is that working? No? Not working? It's all right. Liz is going to fix it for me. Try again. Perfect. Good. Thank you very much, everybody, and thank you, Natasha, for the introduction. Just to clarify before I start off, Lloyds of London, not Lloyds Bank. Okay, it's just if anybody's thinking I'm here to talk about banking, I'm not. It's an insurance market. Just by way of background, Lloyds of London, as I said, is an insurance market. It's 328 years old. We started trading in 1866. No, we didn't. It was 1688. Just making sure if you're awake. And we started with marine insurance. It was mentioned earlier that we set up the industry based on sharing risk on ships. And as somebody said earlier, it was very much just a fly by night, pick a number, any number, and spread the risk around as best we can. Things have changed quite a lot in the last 328 years, mostly in the last 10 years. We didn't do a lot of change for the first 316 years, but we're getting better at now actually modernising our market and thinking more about the importance of some of the work that people have been talking about earlier today. I'm just going to start very quickly with a little bit of personal background. I was an insurance broker for 25 years. And I specialised in professional indemnity insurance. And one of my greatest enjoyments that I took during that time was at one stage I actually was one of the accredited insurance brokers for the Institute of Actuaries. So I did do professional indemnity insurance for actuaries. And I had one occasion, not long after the HIH collapse, where I had to go and talk to one of my clients who was an actuary and explain to them that their premium had gone up. And this actuary looked at me slightly quizzically and said, "Well, I've never had a claim. Why would my premium go up?" Brilliant. So, move on from Tony's slide. Quantifying the threat, talking about cyber insurance. There's been quite a few quotes that have been thrown out there today, so I won't go through them, but my personal favourite was the head of the FBI, who said there are two types of big company in the US. There are those that know they've been hacked and those that don't yet know they've been hacked. Hacking is something that is absolutely endemic. I sometimes even question in our industry whether cyber attacks are insurable, because by its very nature, insurance has to be based on a fortuitous event, not something that is inevitable. And at the moment, the way I'm seeing it, and certainly having heard Tony's presentation, I'm pretty sure it's getting close to inevitable. So it's very clear that nobody is underestimating the potential threat of cyber risk, but there's such a high level of uncertainty around almost every aspect of what we mean by cyber risk. First question is, what are we actually talking about? Cyber is something that Lloyds first started insuring in 1990. It really was IT-based negligence. So it was a failure of an IT system through incompetence or mismanagement as to how those systems were operating. Nowadays, we're talking about such a massive change, and it is changing on a daily basis. So what is the actual exposure we're talking about? How on earth can we quantify that risk? What can we do to mitigate the risk? Talk to Tony is the answer for that one. And then how do we actually risk rate it? And this is where you come in. So how can you actually put a price on something that nobody fully understands? To me, one of the harder questions we also need to look at is how on earth do we as an insurance industry keep up with the rapid evolution of the cyber risks and the cyber threats, which are just changing almost on a daily basis? So as an industry, we're looking at what are the potential drivers of future growth within the cyber sector. Well, clearly the Internet of Things, and I'm embarrassed to say that I did a presentation with Susie not that long ago, and I actually had to Google the Internet of Things to find out what on earth it meant. But I think I've got my head around it now. Increasing attacks. We're seeing, obviously, a huge number of increasing attacks. Tony made the point that most hackers now are professional hackers doing this for a living. They're not just the anonymous group or other people like that, or the, as you said, the hoodie 18-year-olds in a dark room. We're seeing huge increase in risk exposure around business interruption and supply chain. The globalization, the interconnectedness of the planet now with technology-based transactions means that there is a massive increase in exposure to the insurance industry from technology-based risks. We're seeing growth opportunities arising out of industry and government actually getting their stuff together and getting organized around collating data, collating claims data, understanding the threat analysis, and also in putting in place systems and processes for cyber resilience. So things like mandatory reporting are absolutely critical for us as an industry to be able to get our head around what is the risk that we're actually talking about. And then evolving legislation as well. We've obviously talked about a little bit about that with some new EU regulations coming in. Fortunately, being British, I don't have to worry about those anymore because we won't be in Europe next year. I mentioned earlier the first cyber policy was written at Lloyd's in around 1990. Some interesting numbers on this. The first generation iPhone was launched less than 10 years ago. 2007, the first iPhone came out. Apple announced last week that they've now sold 1 billion iPhones. It's a massive number. It's also estimated that there's going to be something close to 1 trillion devices connected by 2020. The entire planet is becoming connected. Cyber is no longer just about the data. As we become more connected and more technology dependent, we're moving away from the strict information technology type exposures much more towards the operational technology exposures or the Internet of Things. This is where we have physical devices, buildings, cars, transportation, systems that are all so heavily interconnected, whether it's a air conditioning unit from Target or sensors in a bridge putting information back into cars about ice conditions or road conditions. These things are all so reliant now on technology that any kind of hacking attack or any kind of cyber attack on these kind of systems is exposing not only data, but very importantly, physical assets and human beings. Excuse me, I've got a touch of man flu, so you have to bear with me. The challenges that we're facing relate very specifically to this global interconnectedness. I've talked about, obviously, autonomous vehicles. We've heard a little bit about those and the Jeep attack. I personally have a Jeep Grand Cherokee with a command system, so I'm expecting to find myself in a ditch anytime soon. And it wasn't my fault, officer, honestly. We're looking now at ships. We're doing some modelling in the UK at the moment with the shipping industry, and we're actually putting container ships and cargo ships out at sea that have nobody on board because we don't need them anymore, because they're all GPS controlled and they're fully independent. But the concern with that is if somebody can hack into a Jeep and crash it into a ditch, they can hack into a container ship and run it straight up the bay in San Francisco full of fertilizer. So we have some very interesting exposures we need to look at around that. Insurance companies often cite their poor understanding of the probable maximum losses as a reason for not making more capacity available. So this is all about understanding these threats and understanding the particular exposures. The Chief Risk Officers Forum outlined 4 specific challenges that they see in relation to the insurance market stepping up to the plate on cyber risk. The first is insufficient or poor quality loss data. The second is total uncertainty as to the value of that data, the loss data. Highly interconnected IT systems and continually evolving attack strategies. So these are some of the key areas that we look at as an industry. In terms of oversight for us, one of the critical requirements that we have is to actually understand what we're dealing with. And ironically, what we need is data. What we need is a clear and consistent understanding as to what data it is we're looking at and where we're getting it from. I mentioned earlier that in 1990, we kind of invented cyber insurance at Lloyd's. Since then, there's so many permutations as to what we mean by cyber insurance. But the industry and the market hasn't necessarily managed to adapt quick enough to be able to give us the minimum core data standards that we need to be able to properly identify where the exposures are coming from and how we can categorise those exposures so we can bring them together. We've recently collaborated with a number of organisations, including LMA, AIR and Cambridge Centre for Risk Studies in the UK, to develop some common core data standards so that we can actually start capturing data around cyber threats that is specific to the type of risk we're talking about, whether it is IT, whether it is operational technology. Some of the common features we're building into that, commonality of geographic information, using ISO country codes for the first time, standard cyber peril codes, which you can see up on the screen, to explain what we mean by cyber, and then also some key indicators on cyber vulnerability, so revenue headcount, type of industry sector, all those sort of things. So the threat of these cyber attacks obviously reaches every part of modern society, we know that, and insurance is a critical factor in helping organisations to manage their cyber risk. The type of work Tony was talking about is critical in order for the cyber insurance to be made available. If Tony wasn't doing what he's doing and others like him, the insurance industry could not tolerate cyber risk. There is no way we would be able to manage this almost intangible exposure to risks that we cannot quantify. So there is still a high level of uncertainty attached to the types of risks we're talking about. So what we do at Lloyd's, we have an emerging risk team at Lloyd's, and the purpose of the emerging risk team, I like to say, is to try and find solutions to problems that people don't yet know they have. So we're forward gazing and looking at where exposures are coming from and how we as an industry can be better prepared to provide the capital backing and the long-term sustainability of the industry to support these emerging risks as they change. So one of the reports that we've published recently is called the Business Blackout Report. And the report has been prepared to really research the economic and insurance impacts of a severe yet plausible cyber attack against the US power grid. So whilst we're focused on the US, we tend to always focus on the US because it's normally the worst case scenario by the time we start bringing things together. And no, we haven't done a Trump analysis yet. although we probably should think about doing that fairly quickly. We do think that these kind of models actually provide a really good framework for thinking about what a severe cyber attack could do elsewhere in the world. It gets the mind thinking, if nothing else. It is important to note, though, the model we're looking at here is not a worst-case scenario. This is designed specifically as a plausible but extreme scenario. So I'm just going to run you through quickly the model that we've done. Given that you're all actuaries and interested in this kind of stuff, on the website, on the Lloyd's website, there is about a 75-page report which provides all of the detail and the background and the research and the numbers associated with this model. So I thoroughly recommend you read it. I've actually read it. I'm probably one of the only people in Lloyd's who's actually read it. Because it's quite long and lots of numbers. But it's interesting reading, and as I said, well worth having a look at. This is the snapshot summary. This is the glimpse, if you like. So the model we looked at was really broken down into five phases of the attack that we looked at. The first stage, obviously, is the research, and this is where we have a group of hostile actors in the US who employ some hackers to develop a piece of malware, which we call the Erebus Trojan, with the intention of installing that Trojan on the electricity generation control rooms of parts of the northeastern US quadrant where there's the biggest exposure to the power generation systems. So the malware is installed, but it goes undetected. And interestingly, in our model, which we see quite a lot of, defenders within those entities, those organizations, do spot some anomalies, but they remediate them and think they've solved the problem, and then they don't share that with anyone. And this is a classic problem we have in the industry at the moment, is where there is a potential threat or an exposure that arises, but people are embarrassed about it. People don't like saying, oh no, we've been hacked, we've had a ransom demand, or we've noticed an anomaly within our industrial control systems within our power plant, because they don't want to admit to it. If they admit to it and people talk about it and we have mandatory reporting and people share that information, then other people are on the alert for it and can look out for it. And it becomes a much more defendable situation. So in our model, the details are not shared. The attacker group then makes a decision in the activation phase, stage three, to execute the attack. So they set off this malware at a number of sites around the northeastern USA. The malware releases its payload, tries to take control of generators across the power grid with specific vulnerabilities. There are around 700 generators in the region that we looked at, and using the base model, and we've used three scenarios here, it finds 50 generators that actually it can hack into and take control of. And that control then gets lost by the operators of the power plants, And we have 50 generators that overload and burn out, in some cases causing fires, explosions, and obviously meltdown within the power generation systems. So this is a hypothetical attack, but it's plausible. It's severe, but plausible. So the blackout basically damages 50 generators across the northeastern USA, including New York City and Washington, D.C. It's relatively limited in scope. As I said, it's around 700 generators in the region and only 50 affected. But what that 50 generator failure does is provide a much wider blackout across the region that we estimate would leave up to 93 million people without power. Okay, 93 million people without power. 50% of that power would be restored roughly within 3 days, with other areas having to take up to a further 2 weeks in order to get power back on grid. One of the problems is the delay time on actually instigating new generators, because a lot of them would have to be replaced. And a lot of generators are made in northeastern USA, but you can't make generators without power. You can see the problem. So the aftermath of this scenario, it takes obviously probably about a year to understand the full scope of the infection and to clean up all the systems. It's very difficult to identify the perpetrators in these types of scenarios. We don't know if it's a terrorist attack, we don't know if it's a lone wolf, we don't know what the motivation was behind the attack, other than just to cause the wrong kind of disruption. So this is a real challenge for us. So looking at the numbers, we developed three variants of the scenario. S1 was a 1 in 150 year event, S2 is a 1 in 100 year event, and X1 was a 1 in 200 year event. And we've modelled that based on power capacity losses that we would expect to see in the event of accidental causes or major weather events. The disruption that this causes is extraordinary. This was one of the interesting aspects to come out of this. This is a cyber attack. Okay, so this is a technology cyber attack using the old terminology. And what we see, the primary effects of these major power blackouts, health and safety, major compromise. Road, industrial accidents, heat stress, generator failures in hospitals, illness from spoiled food, productivity massively impacted, a lot of workplace closures, insufficient energy from backup generators, people unable to get to work, trade is all suspended, ports would be closed, ships unable to be loaded and unloaded, aviation, tourism, all major impacts, transportation, major problems, even water supply, sanitation, loss of power to pumps, contamination from sewage, etc. So a huge amount of direct impact caused by the loss of power over an extended period of time in a major region. Secondary effects in the US, probably primary effects, looting and social unrest. So more issues. So looking at the financial consequences of this scenario, two aspects to it. Obviously you get the economic impacts of the power outage. So you get direct and indirect. You'll be looking at direct damage to assets and infrastructure which need replacing, a huge loss in sales revenues to the electricity supply companies that can't supply electricity anymore, direct loss of sales revenue to businesses who obviously can't trade, and then indirect losses through distribution disruption to the supply chain, and then long-term economic effects which will be felt for some time to come. The models that we've looked at, the direct economic costs ranging between $61 billion through to more than $200 billion for the most extreme scenario. And then with the knock-on effects of supply and demand on GDP, the total impact we expect to be somewhere between $243 billion and $1 trillion in the worst-case scenario disaster. From an insurance point of view, we would expect to see, obviously, a very significant number of claims resulting arising from this scenario. Across multiple lines of business. And this is where one of the challenges that we face within the insurance industry is aggregation of exposure across multiple classes of insurance, directly or indirectly caused by the single event. So the six primary categories of claim that we'd expect to see, obviously power generation companies, they have property damage to their own generators, etc., and business interruption from loss of sales, and then obviously the incident response costs, mandatory notification costs, regulatory fines, all those sort of things. Defendant companies, companies sued by the power generation businesses to try and recover a portion of their loss under defendant's liability insurance, where they've been maybe IT system companies who left the system exposed or people of that nature. And then we get a major part of the exposure, which comes from companies that lose power. And a huge amount of this would be from suppliers' extension risks on business interruption. So if you go out, if your business loses power for 11 weeks or 12 weeks, you're just going to be claiming that business interruption loss directly against the failure to have the power supply. So the exposure that we see there represents about a third of the insured losses coming from that one area. We then also get a contingent business interruption. The supply chain would be interrupted. Homeowners would be affected. Stock spoilage in your freezer at home. Things of that nature. Plugging in your electric car. Can't get to work. And then specialty type risks as well, ranging from anything through to, you know, major events, sporting event cancellations, things like that, which can't go ahead. So in the overall assessment of what the impact would be of this type of scenario, we analyse multiple classes of business to see what the impact would be. And a total of 32 classes of insurance would be badly impacted by an increase in claims arising out of a cyber terrorist attack on the North American power grid. Five of the classes would be very badly affected, and then others would be many of the others would be impacted as well. So looking at this model that we've done, one of the questions is, well, why, you know, is this just scaremongering, or, you know, we're just making this all up just to try and appease the regulators if we looked at this stuff? The simple fact of the matter is that there have been a huge number of attacks on industrial control systems going back even into the late 1990s. We've got a list here up on the screen which you can probably just about read, but the Stuxnet virus is one that has been commonly quoted. It was the uranium Bashir power plant that allegedly somebody, either from the CIA or allegedly maybe from Mossad, left a USB key in their car park. Infected with a virus because they had a closed system that nobody could access, therefore it was secure. And one of the workers picked up this USB key, thought, I wonder what that is, plugged it into his desktop in the power station, in the nuclear enrichment power station, disrupted the entire thing, overloaded the centrifuges, they burnt out, stopped their production for about 2 years of uranium enrichment. So this was a secure system that you couldn't hack into because they had no external access. But all it takes is a human. So those are just some of the more examples around that. But it's not just that one example. US oil giant Chevron had an infection in 2014. There was a steelworks in Germany that got infected as well. Furnaces shut down and caught fire as a result of an infection. So one of the reasons that we're doing all this at Lloyd's, and we're doing a huge amount of research across a number of different areas of risk, is because of the current capital adequacy standards that apply across the UK and into Europe as well for the time being, we're required to actually model these types of scenarios so that we can demonstrate compliance to being able to survive an adverse balance sheet movement based on a 1 in 200 year chance of occurrence. So we're looking at things like the potential impact of a solar storm taking out power generation in North America. Because it is a 1 in 200 year event. Actually, it's a 1 in 150 year event, and the last major storm was 156 years ago. So we're a little bit worried about solar storms, so keep looking up there. But in order to comply with the regulators and Solvency II requirements, these models that we're doing have to cover all material foreseeable risks, including emerging risks. So the modelling has to be complete, which is why we've got a huge number of people, ranging from actuaries, economists, statisticians, engineers, academics and scientists, working on a lot of research into risks that you wouldn't normally associate with the insurance market worrying about. Yes, we worry about bushfires and floods, but we also have to worry about things that we don't yet have a full understanding as to what the impacts would be going forward in order to model it properly. So again, on the Lloyd's website, you'll find freely available a lot of research that we've done into different emerging risks, which, if you're that way inclined, you might find interesting. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Chris. And should I be embarrassed, I also had to Google the Internet of Things during your presentation. Our next presenter is Susie Amos. She's an actuary and principal at Finity Consulting. She leads the research at Finity on cyber insurance and has been particularly thinking about how insurers could best manage this new risk. Please welcome Susie.
Thanks, Natasha. So we've had a bit of a journey through from Tony about the risks of cyber. I've actually just broken the technology. That was Tony, yeah. So Tony's given us a bit of insight on the threats and the risks of cyber and how you might want to protect that from a security perspective. Chris has then talked a bit about the London market, cyber insurance, and given us a bit of a scare about a cyber attack scenario and what that might do to the world and the cost of insurance. I wanted to try and bring it back to thinking about it from an insurer's point of view. So how, as an insurance company and us working in the insurance world, can we respond to these risks that we see out there and help companies and individuals try and navigate this digital world of uncertainty and risks? As you see it, there's certainly a lot of risks, and there's a lot of risks for individuals and a lot of risks for insurers trying to cover these particular areas. But there's also opportunities as well for them in this world where there's not a lot of top-line growth, and also it's a world where insurance has been fairly stable for a number of years. So we haven't really had a new insurance product for a long time, particularly in Australia. So cyber insurance is one that I see is a new product that's coming to Australia, and it's quite an exciting time to be an actuary who can try and help insurance companies navigate this world where there's no data and there's a lot of uncertainty. So what I wanted to talk about a bit today, the current insurance market, so what are insurers currently doing and what are companies currently taking out in terms of insurance. Then go into the exciting part for actuaries about how do we price and underwrite this. Now, there's not a simple answer to this, how do we price and underwrite when we've got no data, but what I want to talk through is just some of the thinking that I've gone through so far and some ideas of how you might tackle this difficult problem. And then finally, I just wanted to think a bit about the future. So what does the future look like for insurance and particularly cyber insurance? What can we expect going forward? So firstly, though, I wanted to just talk a little bit about how does insurance really fit into the world. So for a particular company, they operate every day with a number of risks. They take out insurance such as property liability insurance. And now in this world that we live in, there are a lot of risks around the digital space that they operate in. So they can try and mitigate these risks. They can mitigate them with security measures and going to talk to Tony. But we all know from everything we've talked about here, they can't mitigate all of them. And there are going to be some residual risks that fall through the cracks. So how can a company try and protect themselves for these risks? I think that's where insurance tries to fit in. It tries to fit in to provide them with some money if it does happen. So if the inevitable happens, they get some money for the cost of the cyber event. And also, these days, there's also a bit of help as well. So they're providing them with assistance of what to do when a cyber event happens. So insurance is really, that's what we're there for. We're there to pool risks. We're there as insurers to try and provide protection to companies and individuals to operate in this uncertain world so that they can be more comfortable to do their everyday business. And one of the things I think that I always think about is, oh, surely we see all these risks. We see all these events that happen. We talk about Target and Sony. They're all overseas, and we talked about the US. They're all overseas. I mean, Australia doesn't have those sorts of things. But what I've put up there on the slide there are just a sample of the cyber breaches and events that have happened in Australia. So what do you see? You see doctors. You see lots of ransom. You see Hobart Airport has been hacked by pro-Islamic militants. Private health insurers have accidentally let customer information up on their site, and even Domino's has been hacked as well. So Australia is not immune to this, and so there are definitely risks and companies being impacted in Australia. So what does the current insurance market look like? The global insurance market is currently estimated at about $2.5 billion. Most of that is in the US. You can see from the orange bar there that it has grown quite substantially since 2008, but it sort of took off quite exponentially around 2012-13. Now, that's really around the time that mandatory breach reporting came in the US, and you can see that there's quite a bit of a response from companies taking out insurance after mandatory reporting came in. I'm sure it also increased the cost to companies, it increased the awareness, and it probably increased the cost to the insurers as well. It's estimated, there's a PwC estimate that I've looked at, that they think by 2020 it's going to get to $7.5 billion globally. So it's a market that's growing and still going to continue to grow for a long time. In Australia, we're really at the infancy. The estimates that are out there at the moment is that there's about $10 million of premium written for cyber insurance, so that's just tiny. And maybe by the end of 2016, it might be about $20 million. So we're really at the infancy. There's a very small amount of take-up in Australia, probably because of we don't have mandatory reporting. There's not as many events that have cost companies a significant amount of money. And we've really only started to have products available in Australia in the last couple of years. But going forward, it sort of says to me there's a big opportunity for insurers there. We would expect it to grow exponentially over the next 10 years. Even in the US, I was really surprised by this statistic, and it splits the penetration by corporate businesses and SME businesses. So this statistic says that corporate businesses, about 30% of businesses are actually taking out cyber insurance in the US, and only 5% of SME businesses. So even at $2.5 billion, there is a long way to go in terms of penetration and growth that's available in the market. So what does Australia look like so far? So we know it's in its infancy. It's small premiums and fairly early days. But even so, having a look at the providers that are out there offering cyber insurance products, there's actually a number of providers. I've counted 15 plus, and I think even over the last month I've seen another two products being launched. So it's a very attractive area for insurers, and it's attractive because the growth potential is there, and it's a tough market trying to find premium. So it's a good opportunity to set themselves up for growth in the future. But it's very clear that we are in infancy. We're in this world which insurers aren't quite familiar with, which is a new product, and not quite sure how to deal with it. So there's a number of different policy wordings. There's no standard wording. There's lots of different coverages. There's lots of different triggers. There's lots of underwriting questions. So some of them I've seen actually over 50 underwriting questions for just a sort of an SME-type business, which is a lot of questions to try and take out insurance. And there's a lot of variation in the premiums that are out there at the moment. I've seen small businesses might vary about 10 times the different premiums. And in terms of big companies or corporate companies, for one particular risk, I saw a range of quotes that were, the largest was four times the smallest. So there's a wide variety of pricing and underwriting responses out there. We are in an infancy, it's an unusual environment, and it says that there's a lot of uncertainty. It says that we don't quite know what the drivers are of the risk, and we don't quite know what businesses need in terms of insurance. The other thing that a lot of insurers are providing are response services. So typically we just provide as insurers money when something goes wrong, but a lot of the cyber products are actually providing services such as IT forensics, law firms, access to PR, relations, IT security type services. So it's a little bit unusual from what we see in normal products today, But it's not that unusual in terms of the insurance market. So I'm led to believe, I wasn't there, but when property insurance was first introduced in the 1800s, and maybe you would know this story, Chris, but when a fire happened, the fire brigades were actually part of the insurance company. So you would call your insurer when there was actually a fire. Instead of nowadays, which is provided publicly. So it's just like that from an insurance perspective. For cyber, you actually call your insurance company when there's a breach. So they're trying to provide an environment and a framework which companies can feel comfortable in. So what does cyber provide in terms of the coverage, and where does it fit into the suite of products that companies buy? This table here is trying to give you just a bit of a snapshot of what cyber covers and why it's been created. So you can see there that we've got first party cover and third party cover, and across the columns we've got all the different insurance products. Now, pretty much there's limited coverage for cyber incidents across the traditional insurance products. Crime policies have a little bit of coverage, but otherwise there's not much coverage there at all. So what do companies need to do? What has the insurance industry done? They've provided a new product to fill the gaps. Now, what I find quite interesting is it's a policy that has first and third party coverage. It's so it covers when there's a particular incident that happened. It gives money to the company. It covers business interruption, but also if someone sues the company for a cyber-related event, it covers that as well. So it is a sort of unusual cover in that sense. But even so, insurers these days, because of the uncertainty that Chris talked about, there are still a lot of gaps in the coverage. So insurers are excluding certain things. They're also having quite low limits and high deductibles. These are some of the things where the gaps remain, and it makes it quite a difficult world for companies to try and navigate and understand what exposures they have covered and what will be covered if they have an incident. These are some of the gaps that are commonly coming through some of the policies that are out there. Policy trigger is an interesting one. Some policies are only triggered when there's an actual financial loss to the company, and that could be quite delayed till you know that there's a loss, and how do you actually measure that's a loss? And so you could actually get a number of breaches that don't actually trigger the policy. But that's one which varies across policies. Human error is an interesting one. I haven't seen any stats today, but pretty much I've seen stats around 50% of incidents relate to human error. So employees clicking on links accidentally or not following processes. And a lot of policies actually exclude cover if there's a human error. So that could be a number of cases. Unencrypted data won't be covered if you send data and it's unencrypted. IP and also things like bodily injury and property damage. A number of policies are quite silent on whether it will cover those particular instances. So you can see it's quite a difficult world to navigate as a policyholder, and there's really no consistency across the policies. So with all of those difficulties in terms of coverage and uncertainty in terms of what incidents and costs might come through, it creates a very difficult problem for pricing and underwriting. This is something that I've been trying to tackle with some of my colleagues. At the moment, we're trying to build a pricing calculator, a cyber rater. So we've started to think through, well, what can we do when this is such a new world, there's limited data, and we don't really know what we're covering. So it seems like it's a pretty difficult task. But there are some things that we can think about, and there's a framework that we can start trying to move forward to assist our companies with this. And I think it's a pretty exciting time to try and come up with a solution to quite a difficult problem. So when I started to do this, I started researching, I started looking for statistics and information, and I actually found I felt like this. If basically I felt like there is so much information out there and I don't quite know what to do with it. But at the same time, and as we've heard said before, there's actually no data at the same time as being lots and lots of information. Now, it's really, there is a lot of statistics, but what do they mean? And are they relevant for Australia? Are they actually appropriate for insurance? Well, not necessarily. Are they actually part of the coverage? And how the hell do I use these in a pricing formula? So it's a really difficult task. But what I tried to do is I tried to synthesise the information that was out there, work out what the information was relating to, understand it, understand the definitions. And then what I really realised is there's a little bit of information there and I just have to now start thinking about the underlying drivers. So what are the actual drivers of cost and what are the risks? What are the risk factors that you'd expect to come through? So it's really the beginning of a control cycle. So those hours that you spent learning the control cycle, it's really coming up with a starting point, coming up with a framework that you can then add data onto once it starts to be reported and starts to be available. So three areas that I saw as a good way and a good framework of thinking about risk. The first one, what is the exposure. So, and the key things you can think about is what's the profile of the company? So the company, the industry that they operate in, the size of the business, how many sensitive records they have, what countries they operate in, whether they're online, whether they're whether they outsource. These are all things that are seen to be, and there are some statistics on drivers of risk and relative drivers of risk. Then it's about, well, how is this company actually managing this risk? So there's a qualitative element. There's how they govern their risk framework. And also how they manage cyber risk and educate their employees. So that's really about the quality, just like a governance element. And then there's the IT, security. So how good is their IT systems? How well do they manage the data? There are three things that I started to think about. And it's fair to say that with all of that information and some of the things I've read from what's done recently, this sort of statistic came to mind. It felt like I was going to do a little bit like this. And maybe, I don't know, maybe that's how it's done. Not sure. Probably not. So if we think a little bit more about this framework, I've got this diagram here. So we talked about the exposure, that's the profile of the company. We've got mitigation, that's the governance and also the IT security. And what we want to do is try and come up with the likelihood and severity of those things. But then really link it through to what cover are we going to provide. So this is really a little bit of data feeding into it, but a lot of judgment. So I'm going to go through each of these areas and just give you my thoughts on what I've learned so far of the key drivers of these areas. So exposure. Industry is a key driver of risk. This report that I've got a statistic here is Ponemon report. It's actually relevant for Australia. And you can see there that the financial and the services areas, which probably includes health services, have a high cost and a high frequency of that coming through. Retail have a high frequency as well, and you see a lot of those incidents come through. And that makes sense because they'll have more credit card information, they'll be online, and they'll have a lot more exposure and profile that will make them targets. The next one is size. So size does matter. If you're bigger, you're more likely to get hacked, and it will cost more. But this is a bit of a dynamic trend. It's a changing world. So we've seen, as Tony mentioned, some of the smaller companies, the subcontractors and the outsource companies, are being targeted to try and get to the bigger companies. So if you looked at this statistics a few years ago, you would see that it's grown in terms of the number of attacks that have been made against smaller businesses. So that's a key measure to feed into the pricing. Number of records, so number of sensitive records is also a key measure. The more sensitive records you have, the higher cost it's going to be. So if you've got more records as a potential exposure, you're going to probably have a higher likelihood and a higher cost. So that's a key area to think about. But if we think about sensitive records, well, it's personal information, it's addresses, it's credit card information, it's health information. They're the sorts of things that that actually are worth something by the hackers. Other areas of exposure, so geography. Now, if you're in the US, you have a higher exposure, you have a higher cost because they have mandatory reporting, and you probably know from their legal systems there's a higher risk that you'll be sued and be sued for more amount of money. Online exposure. So there's an incident which was Aussie Farmers Direct, and their online site was hacked and their customer information was actually given out. So that's one where being online is a much higher risk of getting hacked. Outsourcing, we saw with Target, outsourcing has a higher risk because they might not have the security features. So that's another area which is important to consider from an underwriting and pricing point of view. In terms of mitigation, I have lost my comments there, but it's not that important. So how do you price and underwrite for the quality and the governance and the processes that a firm undertakes? Well, it is going to be a qualitative measure, but we do it for directors and officers insurance, and we do it for professional indemnity. So effectively, we're doing a similar sort of thing, and I'd expect to do a similar thing for cyber insurance. The other difficult area I can imagine for underwriters and actuaries is understanding, well, what differences in a network security and data management makes a difference to risk, and how can we possibly know all of that information? One of the things that I've come to the view that there's a lot of external providers who actually know this, and it's their bread and butter, and a number of them provide some vulnerability scores. So why can't we use this measure, get the company to do an assessment, and then feed that into our framework? From what I've seen, there was a presentation that Chris and I did recently, and the speaker there was from the Australian Government at the Cybersecurity Centre, and he basically gave four things that a company can do to reduce 85% of intrusions. So I sort of see those four things as really good measures of understanding risk and risk mitigation. Then we sort of go to cover. So this exhibit is from Ponemon as well, which is an Australian report, and it really is quite consistent with what Chris talked about in terms of the costs that come through from cyber risk. It shows the proportion of costs that are the main drivers of insurance costs are lost business, so that's business interruption, and investigations. So it's not about being sued by someone. It's not about being physical damage to a company. It's about your own business's loss of business, and also investigating and mitigating the risks. So understanding these types of exposures and the types of costs that are coming through is quite important. But what becomes even more important is how are they going to change over time? So when mandatory reporting comes in, we probably expect the notification to increase. We can then go and look at the US stats and get some insights from there and try and feed that into our framework. So just some early insights into the sorts of things to think about from a pricing and underwriting perspective. It's a really difficult task. There's a little bit of data, but a lot of judgment. It means trying to look at the underlying drivers, and where we usually use data and rely on that, we actually have to really understand what the drivers might be. So I see talking to the IT specialists, talking to the underwriters who understand the policy coverage, and keeping up to date with all of the changes in threats and IT risks. So it's going to be quite a different environment, but a back-to-basics environment for pricing and underwriting. So I don't know how I'm going with a time perspective. I'm over. So accumulations and large losses are are going to be tricky things for the industry to measure. There's a lot of uncertainty there, but it's an area where I think actuaries and it's a good place for you to start thinking about how can you add value, how can you help insurers think about the costs that might come through. So doing a number of those scenarios, doing it the US power grid scenario in Australia, and sort of thinking of different types of scenarios and working out the costs is important. But what about the future? So at the moment, the small premium, there's hardly any claims in Australia. Mandatory reporting will come in, and it will mean that that companies will start taking out insurance. There'll be constantly new threats. It'll be constantly changing environment. But business will start to realise that they need to have this protection to be able to operate. So insurers then provide a well-placed to try and provide this environment for companies to operate. There will be streamlining, so we won't have lots of different policy wordings, and potentially it'll become cyber insurance will be covered as part of the normal policies rather than a separate standalone product as it's now existing. But all in all, I think it's quite an exciting time for actuaries to try and to operate in this environment, try and come up with ways that they can price and underwrite without data, and really sort of thinking about the underlying drivers of risks. So that's all. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Susie. I'd like to invite all the presenters up to sit under the screen so we can have them on video for the Q&A. I was just going to ask the first question to Tony. I like the scenario, the business blackout that's done by Lloyds. Do we have the tools to prevent something like that happening?
We do. I suppose the biggest problem is the tools are there, but a lot of people don't know, A, how to use them properly, and B, if they do them properly, what the, let's say, the behavioural aspects of that are in terms of making sure that they comply with, making sure that the right passwords are set, making sure that the right patching is done on systems. I'll give you an example. Catch of the Day. Which is a fairly large website that people are... I'm subscribed to Catch of the Day. They got breached a couple of years ago, something in the order of, I think it was about $5 million breach. Now, they had top-notch security, but they hadn't updated it in 2 years. They forgot to renew their subscriptions. It was as simple as that. So it's just being on top of this all day, every day, and that's how you prevent these sorts of breaches.
And just further on the business blackout... Is that an insurable event, or is that too big?
No, anything's insurable, as long as you've got enough money to pay for it. No, I mean...
How much would it cost?
Well, huge amounts of money. I mean, the issue with business blackout is what it identifies is that one particular event or one action could cause systemic losses across the entire industry. And it could impact up to 32 different classes of business with one event. So from a business owner point of view, understanding the policies that you have in place and whether it extends to include suppliers extension arising from a failure of the power grid, things like that, is critically important, because you wouldn't think necessarily that you're going to be exposed to a cyber attack. But indirectly, a huge number of businesses would be exposed to that kind of event. So yes, I mean, a significant majority of the direct impact of that would be covered by insurance, and the model we put up there showed the extent to which we felt the insurance industry would have to respond. So yes, there would be coverage, but there's also going to be a lot of questions asked.
Questions from the floor?
Jordan here. I was on a Target example before. We had an example where someone hacked through an air conditioner and ultimately cost Target a lot of money. Does the whole market, particularly insurers, intend to deal with who the liability falls into that? So in one way, it's the air conditioner's fault for being able to be hacked, and ultimately it cost Target a lot of money. How do you deal with who takes liability for that? It seems like it's a similar issue to the whole automated cars, and that the liability might fall into the car manufacturers as opposed to the people that own the cars. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And look, you've hit a really good point, and that is the assignment of liability is potentially changing with the world that we're living in. So if you take the autonomous vehicle scenario, as you said, if a vehicle is going along without anybody in it at all and it crashes, is it the software manufacturer? Is it the designer? Is it the manufacturer? You know, who would be responsible? At the moment, the law is clear that, in most jurisdictions, that if there is a person inside the vehicle, irrespective of the systems that are being operated at the time, the person has accountability for the actions of the vehicle. But the scenario gets more convoluted. If you imagine a driverless vehicle going down a road and it's confronted with a situation where a crash is inevitable and the vehicle has to make a decision whether it veers right into a bus, veers left into a bus stop, or hits the child crossing the street in front of them. Now, we talked about, you know, human intervention with technology and whether humans make a decision or whether it's now the technology. A human has to program the car in anticipation of that scenario to make a decision as to which way to go. Now, is that human who programmed the car then culpable for the end result of that accident? So the law does not, at the moment, cater for that situation, which is why we don't actually have driverless cars on the road without people in them. I mean, all the testing they're doing still have people in the cars at the moment. But it's a major challenge for the industry. And one of our biggest potential concerns at Lloyd's is actually the potential accumulation of risk arising from one event like that, where you do have the direct consequences of the power out, but then you have the flow-on effect. And ultimately, who is responsible, and whether the insurer of a homeowner in Washington who loses their fridge contents can subrogate that loss against the power company who subrogates it against everyone else. So you're going to end up with a very, very complex legal situation that needs to be addressed by the regulators to a large extent.
Better? Hello. Thanks for your talks. I thought it was a really fascinating topic and quite thought-provoking. I'm interested in your views on sort of cloud. So a lot of companies have traditionally managed their own data centres, for better or worse, and to a greater or lesser extent abandoning those and moving things onto the cloud, including personal data and things like that. Now, that often comes with a lot of dragging of feet and concerns around security and what have you. Given the illustrations you gave around how badly some of these environments are managed within companies, what are your views around sort of security risk around cloud versus on-premise data centers?
Oh boy. So cloud inherently, the way I describe cloud to people is it's someone else's computer. Simple as that. All right. Now that inherently comes with the same risks that we heard about the outsourcing piece. You're giving someone else responsibility over your data and you're trusting them with your data. Now, there's providers such as AWS and Amazon and Azure, who Microsoft and Amazon, who are aligned, and they put a lot of investment into security. AWS, in fact, so the Australian Signals Directorate, it's one of the highest intelligence agencies in the country, have finally cleared AWS to store classified data on board AWS. So there is inherent levels of security, and AWS have been going out there crazy saying, listen, you can trust us. If the ASD can, anyone can, all right? Yes, that's true. However, there are also cases such as a company called CodeSpaces out of the US that hosted their whole business in AWS, and their administrator access was hacked into, and the company was literally deleted off AWS. Literally, it went, but it ceased to exist after about 5 minutes. There are inherent risks with cloud. You can secure in the cloud as best as you can with on-premises infrastructure, but it's just a bit more difficult. So, hope that helps.
Other questions?
I guess one of the questions that I've got, maybe for Tony, but also links to the pricing. Have we made any progress in understanding the why? Hacking a bank's quite obvious why you'd want to do it, but hacking some poor marketing person's website so they can't operate anymore.
It's sad because a lot of these hacks that happen, say to my friend who had the marketing agency, it's generally speaking, it's an automatic system that goes and looks for vulnerabilities. And when it finds one, it alerts a human and says, OK, I've just found a website that has very simple security. Do you want to log into it and do what you're going to do? Right? So the why is for political reasons, such as the Kurdish separatists, ideological reasons. I want to make some money. I just want to be a pain in the backside. It might be in DDoS's case, so distributed denial of service attacks, where a company's business gets disrupted. The whole idea is that you want to shut them down for a few hours or a few days while they deal with dealing with it. So there's a whole bunch of different elements. I suppose that's why. So do you want to add in case you...
Yeah, look, I mean, that's pretty much it. The main reason that I've seen is money. And you think, well, why would they lock down my system? I mean, nothing to anyone. But basically, they, you know, hold you to ransom to pay money to them to get your own system back. So they don't really care about what's in your system, but they care about the money they get because you care about what you have on your system. So I think key reasons is money, even just personal information, which isn't credit card information, they can sell to marketing companies who then, you know, who use that for their own marketing possibilities. So I think mostly it's money, and then it's political views. But most of the ones I've seen there is just people who want to make a buck, and there's a lot of money in it.
Any other questions? Susie, I've got a question. What's your view on... you talked about take-up of cyber insurance in Australia. Where are we going with that? When do we think it's going to become, you know, bigger and more taken more seriously?
Look, I think it's really linked to mandatory reporting. Once that comes in, I think we'll see quite a big difference in the take-up of insurance. I think also a few more incidents that cost Australian companies a bit more money and a bit more embarrassment than have happened so far. And also smaller companies as well will mean that the smaller businesses will start to realise that they're at risk as to their business as well. And lastly, I think that once there's a bit more consistency and understanding of the coverage that cyber insurance is providing, as well as what the potential exposure is to a business, just like Ali, you asked, you know, well, why? As a business, you think, oh, why me? You know, it's probably not going to be me. But really, companies understanding what their exposure is, then that's when it will, you know, start to take up. But it'll take a long time. I see it a little bit like management liability. Management liability is about 10 years in Australia now. It's only really sort of started to be taken up by businesses. So it's probably a 10-year thing.
Can you just expand on mandatory reporting?
Yes. So mandatory reporting, basically it's a requirement that has been talked about in Australia. It's not actually in force yet, but they are talking about putting it in force. They haven't given an exact time, but there's talk that it's going to be in the next year. And it requires companies to report to the public and to the regulator when there is a particular breach that has happened to their company. And if they do not report it, or if there's a view that they could have avoided that particular incident, there will be penalties to the company because of that.
So under who? Well, who's the regulator?
Well, I don't know who the regulator is.
The Office of the Australian Information Commissioner. That's a mouthful.
There you go. There you go. So it's a new law, and there's discussions at the moment, but obviously that is the office.
Yeah, so there was a bill that was in front of Parliament the day that Parliament went to recess before the election, and obviously Turnbull and Shorten had a bit more to worry about that day than passing a cyber breach notification bill. And then back in 2000, and what was the previous election before last one? 11?
Three.
A week earlier. The It was in front of Gillard, the last sitting day of Parliament, and she had that, 2013. So it's been in front of Parliament twice in the last sitting day of Parliament, and that's why it hasn't been passed. So it's there. It's the same bill. It's almost identical wording-wise. Just needs to get through. And it's got bipartisan support, so it will happen. It's just when they sit down and do it. So.
Thanks for all the presentations. It's very informative. I think Susie, you put up a slide at the end about the future, and you talked about pricing and underwriting and all that. Just given the amount of uncertainty going forward and the capital that an insurer would need to hold to really comfortably within their risk appetite, all that stuff, do you really see this as a living offered by the big insurers when it's all streamlined and the policy coverage becomes streamlined and you get better take-up rates, because at the moment, as you said, the products are pretty crap. Mm. And none of the companies find it easy to really, read into it and want to take this on or, buy it. So going forward, do you see you going down that path?
Well, currently, it's fair to say that it's being offered by the big guys and by small guys as well, but really from small guys in terms of underwriting agencies who will then feed the risk back to Lloyd's or other companies externally. So even though it looks like it's offered by small guys, it probably is the big guys. So, yeah, look, in terms of capital, there's a fair bit of capital that's required there, but the way insurers are dealing with it is in terms of reinsurance. So then there's a big question from the reinsurers if they're able and willing to take on the reinsurance. Just like they do, I guess, with any sort of catastrophe exposure.
My question is more for Tony, I suppose. Sorry, were you going to say something on the back of that?
Just a very quick word on that. Just from Lloyd's perspective, obviously, we run about 59 different syndicates or managing agents at Lloyd's who are all individually managed, and we oversee them as the corporation of Lloyd's. We've developed a cyber attack strategy within the Lloyd's market to make sure that the syndicates that we're operating are properly capitalised to be able to take care of aggregated and accumulating risk on the cyberspace. Every managing agent has been required to submit to us a 3-scenario severe but plausible example of where they could be exposed to an accumulation of cyber risk, and we're making sure that they individually have got the right capital backing to be able to support that underwriting that they're doing. We also then, obviously Lloyd's is a bit different, and we have the central fund, so we have a very large pot of capital to secure those risks, but we are very concerned about the potential to exposing that central fund to an aggregation of cyber risk which we hadn't seen coming, which is why we're doing so much work around it. And Suncorp are no different. Every insurer's really focusing on those key issues.
I'll just say one more thing. Just in terms of the uncertainty, the way insurers are dealing with it is high deductibles and low limits. So actually, if you look at the exposures, it is limited from a vertical perspective, so then it's the horizontal. I don't think so, no. So I think there's a limited understanding of what cover companies need, and so there's not that often that a particular company would say, I want more cover. Yeah.
Cool, finish. So my question is more around how you see the evolution of the financial system, because I think part of the issue is banks are, realistically, once you go past the facade, the sophistication is actually still running on antiquated systems. And there's a lot of sort of easy openings at the moment, but what's your view on the way things are evolving and even the advent of blockchain and what that might do to a public ledger type view of financial system?
I don't know, to be honest. I mean, you've seen two-factor authentication now coming in, that's been around for a long time. I think a lot of this is reactive, sadly. A lot of security, and I'd love to say that people get out of bed in the morning and go, you know what, I'm going to update my cyber security. They don't. Typically speaking, they've been hacked. All of a sudden, they realise that they need to update their cyber security, and then they come screaming for us and to help them out. we do talk to a lot of people proactively, and banks sadly at times fall into that trap as well. They get done, and then they realise they've got to make changes. Then you've got that moment of business opportunity to speak to them about, you know, a proactive solution, and then once that moment's gone, it's gone. So I don't know where the future's going to go. I suppose watch this space. Sorry, I can't be more clear. No?
Yeah. Any other questions?
Hi. Hello. Hello. Okay, that's good. Thank you for your talk today. So I've just got, a question about your views of the distribution channels that you think would be, most effective and would get this higher growth for these businesses. What kind of distribution channels do you think would be quite helpful for cyber insurance? Would it be through security software companies when someone buys that software, they might have an add-on for that insurance
So one of the things that we're doing as a business is cyber insurance is not an area of expertise for us. We work with our cyber insurance providers and the like to provide coverage, but it's an area that we basically say, look, we can do the technical side and you guys can do the insurance side. But we write it into all of our documentation to say you should get insurance. In cases where companies are breached, we will typically suggest to them to speak to a list of providers, as well as speak to a list of legal people who can help them in case they need to mitigate against the reputational damage, etc., etc. So from our perspective, we involve companies as they go along.
I made a comment a couple of years ago about cyber insurance that the problem to me with cyber is that it was a product that was being designed and written by insurers that didn't understand it, sold by brokers that didn't have a clue what it was, and bought by customers that didn't understand what they were buying. Other than that, it was a great product. I'm inclined to think that we're closer to getting to the point where there is a better understanding. There's a lot more press and media attention given to cyber breaches. The mandatory reporting, I think, is an absolutely imperative thing to do in order to raise awareness and understanding of the importance of the exposure to businesses, whether they're in the IT sector or not, because everybody is exposed to it. In terms of how do we increase the take-up, I think the first thing to do is we have to get mandatory reporting in there because it immediately raises awareness. The education piece around partnering with experts outside of the insurance industry I think is critical. Our industry has always been very insular. We're very internally focused. We have an underwriter who used to write motor vehicles in the 1980s, who's now writing cyber insurance and training up the young guy coming through how to write autonomous vehicles. But they're not technicians. They don't understand the technology. So I think that one of the most important things for our industry is attracting in talent into our industry that brings in expertise from the fields in which we're now exposing our capital. So we can't just get young brokers coming through being trained by middle-aged brokers, being trained by old brokers. We've got to actually bring in some expertise that meets the needs of the rapidly evolving world we're in. But I do think brokers are the very best distribution channel who can provide professional advice to the customers, but they need to bring in that expertise to be able to do it.
Yep, look, I agree. My answer was going to be through the brokers. And then really how do you get the uptake through brokers? And it's really about education and them understanding what the risks are for the businesses and what coverage is being provided. And so understanding the risks, it then means pulling in the IT security specialists so that they can give lots of examples of what's happened and what types of risks and exposures that an individual company has. And I guess the other side of that, there are a few specialists
agencies who are focusing on cyber, so having particular specialised offerings can mean that that understanding can increase, and they can educate brokers and other other companies to help them understand that.
I just wanted to add very quickly to the skills piece. So cybersecurity generally has a massive skill shortage at the moment. My background was computer science. I never saw myself doing cybersecurity except for the little bits that I used to do at school. The way that my career over time has evolved, and I'm mindful of the fact that, you know, the audience is a bit younger, and I suppose it's more a bit of advice, potential advice, is that over time the needs have sort of shaped where I need to go in my career. And over time, having learnt what I've learnt, plus the questions I've been asked and the companies I've been dealing with, I've gone and then studied further and studied further. I've identified a need within the legal space for someone who has cybersecurity IT experience to be able to work in that space. So potentially in the next couple of years, I'll be studying law to actually personally meet that, right? So what I'm essentially saying is that you're all very bright, and you've all got your careers ahead of you, and having a bit more in-depth knowledge of what you're going to practice hands-on might serve you really, really well down the track. So keep it as an open, you know, as something in your mind that you can in time, you know, consider. So
thank you for that.
Please join me in thanking our presenters for Plenary 2. Concludes our presentations for today. Please thank you again, Sententia, for sponsoring Plenary 2. So we've been on quite a journey of different areas that actuaries could get involved in. At one end of the spectrum, Ron talked about going out of our traditional skill set into a world that's less technical and more ambiguous. At the other end of the spectrum, we had a discussion about data being king, but how we analyse it has evolved with many new tools and technologies available. Chow reminded us that actuaries can partner with non-technical people to achieve different financial and non-financial outcomes. And the discussion on cyber risk highlighted our changing world and how the insurance industry needs to develop and innovate to respond. So I'd like to thank all the presenters for a very interesting afternoon, and I'd like to welcome David Bell once again to close the seminar.
Thank you very much, Natasha. Great job. Look, I'm very conscious I'm staying between you guys and drink and food, so I'll be very quick, but it's always important to recognise people who've done a great job. Firstly, feedback. If you've got any feedback, love to see it. You've been texted links. Send your information back to us. We always like to improve the things that we do. If you're so inclined to come to another conference, just a reminder that between the 13th and 15th of November, we have our GI seminar, which is being held in Melbourne later this year. I invite Chow and Tony to come to the front of the room to receive our thanks for sponsoring. So firstly, Tony, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Much appreciated. We love our sponsorship. Would you like a photograph here? Yeah, sure. Oh, we can do it afterwards. Let's do it afterwards. Yeah, let's do it afterwards. I hope this doesn't end up in the smallest room in the house. Yeah. And Chow, thank you very much. Chow, my bosses, of course, hence I'm so polite to him. He's on our council. Chow, thank you. And thank you very much to our sponsors. I'd also like to, of course, echo Natasha's thank you to the speakers. Thank you for taking the time out of your day to come and speak to us. Tony, I'm not quite sure whether you should be encouraging actuaries to do more formal study. They're pretty sick of it after they get there, if I may. I know what you meant. Now, a big thank you to our organising committee. I might get you stand up when I read your name, just so we can acknowledge you. Firstly, the convener, Bill Constantinidis. Bill. Let's not have tapping at each point. Let's just read them all out. I hope I get this right. Kui Ling Lu, Rashi Bansal, Finalia Kakao, Justin Portelli, I need to wear my glasses, obviously, Kelly Lee, Lisa Yi, Hai-Yen Lee, Chris McCullough, Irene Lay, and Liz Gemmell from the Institute. Thank you very much. Thank you also to our events team. Thank you, Liz, from the events team. You did a great job. And
finally, thank you again to Natasha. It's hard work facilitating. As I said to you this morning, my experience is you normally go to bed very early, exhausted. You need a drink. Okay, I think we all need a drink. That was a hint. Please join us for a drink at the back of the room. Thank you very much.